Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 692.MT1424, certificate number 18688, Kon-Tiki.
To solve the mystery to their own satisfaction, six men purposely set themselves adrift on an ocean which, even yet, is not completely charted.
You're an explorer.
I am absolutely not.
Out.
I like to go for long walks.
Mm-hmm.
Does that count?
I think.
I do like the mystery of a walk where I'm not quite sure where we're going to go, or especially just kind of the unlooked for moment of grace of seeing something good I didn't know I was going to see.
So
I guess I'm an explorer at heart.
Do you take the same route every time when you go to familiar places, or do you take different routes?
For errands, I will kind of always take the same route. I'm also an optimizer.
Right.
But if I'm just walking the dogs or walking around the neighborhood, I will actively try to like find streets I haven't walked down or views I haven't seen.
You've been down all the streets in your neighborhood.
It's a pretty beta kind of explorer, though. I mean, it's not exactly climbing Everest to discover a new pocket park in West Seattle.
Your folks moved you to Korea when you were young as part of their careers, sort of chasing a kind of international life, but they weren't migrants. They went out, but then returned to close to home.
Yeah, they.
What kept them from staying in Korea after they'd been there as long as they were there?
That's an interesting question, because going native kind of is an option. I haven't lived in Korea for 92, almost 30 years.
Wow.
And even the long timers, the people I thought of as lifers, who are just expats or, whatever kind of quasi embassy, quasi military way they had found to set up shop there, most of them aren't there anymore. A few of them married local people, and started a new family there. And maybe a couple of those are still there.
If you went back to Seoul, would it feel like home?
I've been back so many times, and it doesn't feel like home, not just because everyone I know moved decades ago, but also just because the city has had an amazing revitalization. They cleaned out the river, and they tore down the elevated highway, and it's a modern, bustling Pacific Rim city, and not kind of the Asian tiger capital struggling toward the developing world that it was in the 80s.
Right.
But it felt a little like exploration. The reason I like to explore cities is because of those memories of just kind of running or biking around Korean streets as a kid with kind of the imperviousness that an American felt overseas back then, king of the world.
But yeah, do you when you read about the age of exploration, and I guess the age of exploration, there were several of them, and it lasted for several hundred years, many hundred years.
Each better than the last, unless you were a colonized people.
Until pretty recently, actually.
Yeah, there was stuff to explore into the 20th century.
When you read about that time, do you identify with that impulse? Could you picture yourself at some point in if you were a person born in the 16th century, would you have gotten on a ship and headed out to the unknown?
I'm always of two minds. And on the first place, you're like, oh, sure. You know, I love to see, I love maps.
Right.
I love seeing new sites. I do, as I say, I like the unknown. I like when a family trip has some unexpected side trip or discovery that kind of turns out to be added value.
You love ink and gold.
Is that what drives explorers?
Well, at one point. I don't think the explorers of Alaska were...
Maybe more gold than ink.
...driven by ink and gold.
But on the other hand...
Not ink and gold, but
oh,
the gold of the Inca.
Ink and gold. I thought these were the two things that explorers wanted. They wanted ink. We know they wanted ink, but
also driven by ink.
A fun fact: they also liked gold.
Yeah, if they were there as they were collecting ink from the ink trees.
I thought this was some version of gold and spices that I had never heard before. Yes, no, I, you know, as a kid, just fascinated by buried treasure and the idea that you might find Confederate gold in your fireplace, or I was always digging up the backyard for that kind of thing. But here's mm-hmm. why I'm not going to be a good explorer.
Yeah.
I can't go to sleep without my white noise machine.
You know? Your pillow. You need your pillow.
Like, here are the three kinds of Costco raw veggies I need in my fridge today, or I'm going to pitch a little fit.
Right.
And add something to the shopping list on the fridge. You know?
In big letters too, right?
Yeah.
Like, how did we forget?
Where are the baby carrots?
Yes.
Underline, underline, underline.
Right.
So that's not the soul of that's not somebody who's going to get aboard a Spanish galleon.
Right. You're not going to live on canned milk for 2 months because you ran out of root vegetables.
And do you think the explorers didn't mind that, or were they just willing to put up with it because their love of the first thing was so great? Or is there a certain kind of person who kind of likes the survivalist, close to the bone, can of beans lifestyle?
There are so many people, even in our modern times, that if they could live on Soylent Green, they would. In fact, they do.
Yeah, Ted Bundy.
You know, a lot of people, not Soylent Green, I guess, Soylent. There are a lot of people for whom the sensual pleasures, food and drink, just don't factor into their...
And might even connote weakness. And,
yeah, exactly. Like, oh...
Decadence.
You want things to taste good?
Ken wants electricity at his house.
If I could just eat paste, I would, and you can.
He wants a soothing noise at night so his sleep can be refreshing.
But, you know, who knows? Like, wealth motivates some people. The pursuit of wealth motivates some people to the point that they don't sleep and don't have human relationships.
You think some of these explorers are just the equivalent of a modern day soulless finance guy or a home day trader? Like, this is their get rich quick scheme?
That has to motivate some, but also I think that the desire to have your name live in the annals of history, to be the first person to set foot somewhere, you know,
that seems a little more noble.
That's it also powers people. And then
the noblest goal of all would be scientific discovery, you know, the unknown horizon, the threshold at the end of the world.
At different periods, people have been motivated by a desire to spread the gospel, which, as you know, I mean, to us,
no downside.
There's no downside to spreading the gospel.
Nobody ever got the worst of that.
You know, to us in the 21st century, we look back at the Spanish desire to convert the New World to their version of Catholicism by the sword. You know, we're very critical of it, but people walking through neighborhoods with pencil protectors ringing doorbells trying to convert people to their way of thinking, we're only mildly contemptuous of.
We're annoyed by it. This is the best thing you can say about Mormon missionaries, is we're only mildly annoying.
Only mildly annoying.
We're no longer, we're no longer slaughtering the families that don't answer the doorbell.
I was sitting on my porch the other day, and two young men in short-sleeved white shirts, which is amazing. Like, you would think they would try and camouflage themselves. They were walking across the street up the sidewalk. And, you know, my driveway is fairly long, so I'm kind of way back off the street, sitting on my porch. And one of the kids he had to be 80 yards away, called across the street, "Hey, really relaxing, eh?" And I looked up and, you know, here were these kids, and they were on a separate mission. You know, they were going from house but I was, you know, all I could do was, you know, give a friendly nod like, "That's right. You know, just relaxing. Thanks for checking in."
Why didn't you say, "I do a podcast with a Mormon guy"?
Hey, listen, some of my best friends are Mormons, so you can leave me out. But I mean, part of Christianity is evangelizing. It's right there in the, it's in the book. Spread the word.
Hopefully, I mean, the book doesn't say do it by the sword.
Right. It doesn't
say. I mean, you're free to think, you know, offer it as a friendly invitation and not as a force of cultural annihilation.
That's right.
Although it is kind of implied, if the stakes are heaven and hell, you know.
What are you going to do?
That does excuse a whole lot of zealotry.
Think about all the Huguenots that were drowned by Charlemagne. I mean, we don't shed a tear for them.
I can't think about the Huguenots. I get too sad.
So all these different motivations that have compelled people over the centuries. I mean, there's a whole school of science devoted to trying to understand and interpret human migration. Without human migration, there wouldn't be, well, we wouldn't have infected the world like a plague.
Yeah, we think of exploration as a thing that a certain period of Portuguese people did, you know? A certain thing that white ocean-going peoples did for a few hundred years. But obviously, for the Earth to be populated, there was a lot more exploring going on than that.
And I think of when you think of kind of a distribution of talent within any given human population. I mean, if you think about any group of 1,000 people, you're going to have people that are naturally inclined to be good administrators, naturally inclined to be proselytizers, shopkeepers, farmers. I mean, all of those different jobs
chefs,
that's right. Complainers, whiners.
You can do that and have another job. You can be a cellist and a whiner.
But there does seem to be a kind of distribution curve of inclination, mm-hmm. because I would not be satisfied to be a farmer, but there are people who love to be farmers, and I don't think it's just how you're raised. You know, I think it's something to do with however it is that nature works, whatever the mysteries of God's hand are. I've always felt that I was someone that was made to live on the edge of a settlement.
Yeah, you're going to go to Slab City.
Yeah, I'm not somebody that lives in the center of town. I'm not involved in the day to day.
You probably shouldn't have run for city council if you don't want to be involved in the day to day and live in the center of town.
I learned that. That was a learn by doing episode. But you know, I just have always felt like if there was, you know, wherever the border of the civilized area was, I'm not somebody that wants to live like 1,000 miles from the nearest person. I just want to be the last person you meet on the road out of town.
What's the appeal of that to you? One side without neighbors? Is it actually a feeling of well-being? You don't feel hemmed in? You got an escape route?
I don't feel hemmed in. I like to observe. So I like to be able, I would love to be able to sit above a town on, you know, where the road goes into the forest and be able to just see everyone that comes and goes, kind of look at the life of the town, feel involved, feel like.
But to have a godlike sense of.
Yeah, and sort of like old Roderick lives out by the edge of the, you know, he runs the.
Why don't you have a crazy old mansion on the hill because your parents ran the tanning factory?
Yeah, that's kind of, well, that's sort of what I'm trying to accomplish out here in lonely Normandy Park, to be like on the edge of the town here, one of the gatekeepers of the southern gates.
Is this how you explain to yourself the narrative of moving to the suburbs? It's not it's not getting old and selling out in any way. It's moving to the periphery so I can see society more clearly.
But it is something that's in my nature that I've struggled with throughout the course of my life.
Even like, when you lived in cities.
Yeah. Do I belong here only temporarily? And where do I belong? You know, I've done a lot of traveling and I always felt most comfortable kind of if not in motion, then, you know, then somewhere in an orbit rather than in the heart. I don't feel comfortable under the dome. I feel comfortable just outside the dome.
Motion's good for, I mean, I don't want to say demons, but motion's good for any kind of a troubled soul. I wonder if all these explorers were just unhappy. Was Magellan running around the world, or was he running away from something inside Magellan?
Yeah, that's, and there are, I mean, migration happens when there are pressures on a population where there aren't enough jobs or there aren't good opportunities, the conditions are bad.
You talked about how a certain percentage of people want to fall in certain roles, and that, you know, as long as that matches what the sustainable economy is there, that'll work. As soon as you have too many of the wrong kind of person, the colony has to change.
Yeah, and people move in search of opportunity. People also move when they feel chased, you know, like war or desertification. Like, your environment can become uninhabitable and you have to move. But you also, I mean, every
sort of... You don't want to live like a refugee.
You don't. You don't have to live like a refugee.
Did I get the lyrics wrong?
Well, you said you don't want to live like a refugee. Some of us do, but you don't have to.
But what did Tom Petty say? I can't
remember. He said you don't have to live like a refugee.
That makes more sense.
And then the bass player said, don't have to live like a refugee. But so, I mean, in a lot of mammalian societies, like the boys coming of age get pushed out.
Yeah, if you've got a new alpha gorilla, he's going to have to go start his own pod somewhere.
Right, get gone. And so human populations just naturally, well, they're just migratory by nature. And it's a
implication of exponential growth.
Right. And it was only the advent of technology that enabled people to travel long distances and you know, germs, guns, and steel enabling...
Got to have your three things.
That's right.
You want ink, you want gold, but first you need to have guns, germs, and ink,
and steel, and domesticated cattle, and grain.
I figured it out. We should just say Aztec gold, and then you avoid this whole problem.
Oh, sure. Okay,
Aztec gold. Should we redo the show from the top and just say Aztec gold this time?
We can just fly the word Aztec in and just put it over Inca, and then the whole joke will be ruined.
It'll be incomprehensible.
That won't be the first time. So we do think of the age of exploration and the age of colonization as you were saying, a pretty localized phenomena that was very much like...
Once we had clipper ships.
Portugal and Spain and Holland.
I guess not clipper ships.
Going out into the world.
Once we had good sails.
And spreading only disease and war.
And Catholicism.
And stealing everything that they touched. But
stealing some ink.
Stealing
some gold.
But for there to be peoples in the Americas, they had to have migrated there at an earlier time. And there's, I mean, human migration theory, there are, just as there are in any of the social sciences, as many theorists as there are grains on the sand of the beaches of the world.
The chalkboard says, number one, Africa. Number two, ?
Right.
Number three, human race. And there's still disagreement about a lot of the middle steps, right?
There are a lot.
It's all prehistoric.
There's a lot of disagreement, and as we are more and more able to decode the genome, in some ways that is clarifying. In a lot of ways, it just adds to the confusion because, you know, the genome can tell a story to a certain point, but the genome is easily contaminated, and it's also
not a complete record.
It's not a complete record, so. But the desire to leave home, I mean, most of the population of urban areas in the world today grow by migration rather than by internal growth. Like the citizens of Seattle are not having enough babies to cause the population to increase by 20%.
And even if they did, those kids will never afford a house in Seattle.
Well, so. Sure. I mean, but they all, except for the ones that went to Northwest School, and then they moved down to Normandy Park. But so populations tend to, in the modern world, I mean, there's local migration, there's intranational migration, and that's the majority of migration, actually, is people moving around in their own country.
I mean, just walk around Seattle and ask people what state they were born in. Washington is going to be not the majority answer anymore, maybe?
That's right.
I don't know.
It's more and more unusual to find someone that was born in Seattle. And so you and I, you know, high five, am I right?
I do really feel like it's some sense of, even though I'm a bit of a fraud because I lived overseas for so long.
Well, I grew up in Alaska, but that makes me more authentic, not less.
Oh, same with Korea.
For sure.
What could be more Seattle than living in Korea for 11 years?
But there, you know, but that era of transcontinental, transoceanic, what we think of as conquest, but what I think, you know, in the grand scope of history,
it's just a road trip.
Is just migration, yeah. Right? Because those, sure, that initial contact was violent, but, and there was a lot of violence in the migration, but there's...
The force that drives most of it for the individual level is, my crops died, let's go over here.
Yeah.
Or...
New opportunity.
My dad's mad at me, let's move over here.
And what the historic record masks is just the violence intrinsic to every migration that's ever happened. Nobody moves into a new territory where there's anything else and doesn't encounter violence almost immediately.
You can't even move into a new homeowners association without getting a few angry
looks. Oh my God, I'm in a battle with both of my neighbors. I have two neighbors. And within 3 months of living there, I'm in a battle.
See,
this
is why you got to live on the edge of town. You'll only have one neighbor to fight with.
That's the thing.
And then open fields.
And it really does feel in some ways prehistoric. I moved into a neighborhood, and both of my neighbors were encroaching over the property line by dozens of feet. And when I addressed the issue with them, they both had hostile reactions. And I was like, wow, I feel like I'm in some crazy, like
you're in some cow ranchers versus farmers western.
Yeah, or it's something super deep where it's like as soon as you plant a stake in the ground, somebody else comes. It's like it's basically like should there be private property or should there not? As soon as you put a stake in the ground, somebody's disputing it. But as far as the theories of human migration go, they just as we have kind of danced around already in this episode, it's very political. Right. As soon as you...
In what way?
Well, in that land and identity and nationhood and what constitutes a people, I mean, nationhood and identity is super rooted to the land for a lot of people. This is our land. This is where we're from. This is who we are.
I guess for everyone, that's an illusion. It's just whether your people came here 10 years ago or whether your people came here 2,000 years ago.
And how did you get here, right? Mm-hmm. Are you Korean? No. And there's a clear distinction between you and the other occupants of Seoul because you look different and you speak a different language. But language isn't... Language is nation establishing, but you could have grown up in Korea speaking Korean.
What if I love K-pop enough that it reaches across those barriers?
That's right. So you can't, it's not determined by language. It, until not very long ago, was determined pretty ironclad by what we thought of as race.
Yeah.
But as we explore the genome and realize that race is also just kind of, to a UFO, race would be... not really perceptible.
That's what I learned on all those Star Trek episodes where they're like, people used to judge each other based on skin appearance. Captain, that is quite illogical.
That's outrageous.
Yes, but in the mid 20th century, Spock.
It's weird because there's one person of each race on this crew, and yet we don't see race. So
the Enterprise is funny because it is
very strange.
It is pretty much like a white crew. Like their idea of diversity is like we have a Scottish guy,
right? A guy from East Block,
and then on the bridge crew we'll have like one African American person, one Asian American person,
one Vulcan, one Klingon.
And like at the time, that is so progressive that like Southern TV stations won't air it. But you watch it now, and you're like, oh no, they have like one token receptionist. Like at every station. Yeah,
there's a green skin girl. They all have good boobs though. It doesn't matter what race you are.
Well, that just means the future is going to cure a lot of problems.
Yes.
It's going to cure starvation. It's going to cure disease. And it's going to cure bad boobs.
K Ken, we've come up with some exciting t-shirt designs in the last couple of months. What can you tell us about t-shirts going forward?
I like the December ones. After years of requests, we have finally decided there should be an omnibus shirt with a mail truck on it.
Yay, mail truck shirt.
And it's fun. It's got Mr. Zip driving the truck, that kind of nightmare-inducing representative of the post office's zone improvement plan. And he's having a fun time driving his mail truck on its last legs. And it says omnibus. And then there's a different shirt.
He's kind of ghost riding, isn't he? He's a little bit out of the truck. Like he's only got one arm and one leg.
And he's leaning out the right side, but that is correct.
Yeah, that's
right. That's the right side. His hood is up. It's smoking. He's quite a rakish young man. He's a real daredevil here.
Yeah. Huh.
And then this is the de Havilland Beaver, right? You talk about the aviation one because I can't remember what this is.
It is. It's the de Havilland Beaver from the front end.
It's landing on a Alaskan lake with its sea pods, with its pontoons.
That's
or sea pods, as we call it.
That's right. It's a float plane, as we say in the parlance. It shows its very distinctive and characteristic radial engine from the front. So there's no mistaking the profile of the de Havilland Beaver.
These are some good-looking shirts about some popular omnibus entries. Two new designs every month, so these will be gone at the end of December. Don't miss out.
That's right. This ad has a time limit. You've got, what, over 2 weeks, so almost 3 weeks.
Go to omnibusproject.com/store. You'll always see the links to our two new shirts that our friend Dave has up for us at Mediocrity. You'll also find a link to our T Public store where we have a wide array of stuff with the omnibus logo on it. Hoodies, what else? Hats, I think. Mugs.
Onesies?
Phone cases. Yeah, onesies, but only in adult sizes.
Ha 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 ha! Rawr. If you show up at my house in an omnibus adult onesie,
yes,
you can spend the night.
How does that sentence end?
Maybe in my guest room, but definitely you can spend the night.
So don't forget, if you're interested in omnibus gear for a limited time only, head to omnibusproject.com/store.
That's omnibusproject.com/store. Migration is political in that it suggests, it's not so much that we have a proprietary interest in places, but that culture influences culture, right? You can feel an ownership, you can feel a sense of belonging even in places where, I mean, there are tiers of belonging. And
right. And it can happen quick.
It can.
Like I had a Batman sense of proprietary ownership of Seoul, Korea when I was in the fifth grade, you know, a city where I had only lived for a few years and didn't fit in at all. But you're so shaped by your atmosphere that you see those connections, you feel them very keenly.
You do. And I mean, in the Americas, if you are an Italian immigrant in the United States, or a Spanish immigrant to Mexico, your origins in Europe are not very different. And the distinctions aren't, from the standpoint of us in the 21st century, those distinctions like a Spanish person or an Italian person in 1500, there we think of them as just sort of white Europeans. But not very many generations apart, the great-great-grandchildren of that Spanish immigrant to Mexico and of that Italian immigrant to New York City now are perceived as
the opposite side of a big cultural divide.
Sure. And different races and different cultures that have then different like proprietary sense of,
and it's because of the migration. It's because of where they moved to and the new culture that shaped them.
And the culture that then sort of produced as a virtue of that migration. So, in the mid-20th century, this stuff was all very exciting to people. We were in a time where the era of exploration was kind of drawing to a close. Mm. There weren't that many places that hadn't been at least explored by modern, you know,
there's like a 30 year period where we get to the South Pole, we get to Mount Everest, you know, the moon's coming up, but earthly exploration kind of ends in one generation.
Yeah. There are some places in Siberia that you think no one's been to, but then you get there and there's like, oh yeah, somebody came through here already. I mean, they're up the Amazon. We've already talked about
uncontacted
people, but those are people who got there just somewhere and then somehow got cut off, right? They went a little bit further than their neighbors and
their culture became about the isolation and the cutoff.
Right. And so, you know, and that even, I mean, there were over 200 years where Japan tried to isolate themselves from the world. And it was only technology. I mean, I'm talking about in fairly recent history.
Sure, 19th century.
It was only the technology of the cannon and the steamship that broke that blockade. But in the mid 20th century, there started to be exploration of the adventure sports kind around the world in 80 days.
And I often think that is an implication of all the places being gone. You know, once you can't stand on a new exciting vantage point anymore, you kind of have to make the goal a little more baroque.
Right.
You know, I'm going to be the first person to do X in a balloon,
right,
or in an airplane or the other direction or this combination of places.
Yeah. The first person to unicycle from Boston to Los Angeles.
Because the pioneer impulse is still there and the game board for it is gone.
And testing oneself and, you know, and I guess the measure of man, making it to the South Pole is not a question of, can you walk this distance or dog sled this distance?
It's not the fittest guy who did it first.
Right. It's, can you survive the hardship? Can you live without your baby carrots?
And the logistical challenges as well. Right. You know, it tests a bunch of different skills once it's no longer, you know, who can make it up this, who's the fittest set of arms to make it up this cliff face.
But the mid 20th century, the late 19th century, up to fairly recently, was the era of ethnography and the era of cultural anthropology. The desire to have not only theories of culture, but theories of race, theories of psychology and fitness, even before psychology was a discipline, in eras where science and pseudoscience and theory and cultural studies all were still in a kind of primordial soup of intellectual, pursuit, where scientists still tended to be rich, lay people who had an idea and pursued it. We were still in the immediate aftermath of Darwin and the fact that you could misinterpret Darwin and misinterpret Marx kind of at your leisure, right? You could take Darwinism and apply it socially, mm-hmm, economically.
I guess with the enlightened intellectual idea that I'm going to learn something, like I'm going to learn something from these other people. You know, the earlier explorers were trying to imprint the new territory with their own stamp. The ethnographers have a lighter touch.
And it's post-Enlightenment thinking, right? The right. Early explorers.
I can't guarantee that I'm right. Like, this is a pluralistic world where these new peoples have something to teach me as well.
And also the idea that that uncontacted people were pure,
right,
and angelic. They hadn't been corrupted. All of these ideas were in this stew, and the scientific method was applied to it ad hoc.
So not all the science was great?
Not all the science is great. If you're Michael Rockefeller and you have the money and you want to go live, you want to go find the headhunters, you know, you can make a case. You can go back to the Explorers Society in New York or in Whitechapel and give a lecture, and all the long beards are harumph harumphing about it, And in the end, some of
the Royal Geographic Society is in South Kensington, not in
Whitechapel. Sorry. You're of course, right.
The residents of future Neo-London are going to be furious if we don't get that right.
Yeah, Whitechapel. What am I even talking about? But a lot of those theories and a lot of that exploration did add to what became the kind of, you know, global geographic understanding, cultural understanding. A lot of it was also marred by insensitivity or in a lot of ways by really super flawed theory.
But I, you know, at best, romanticization of these people. But I'm sure it preserved a lot of knowledge that otherwise would have been lost in a very rapidly changing century.
If you think of migration and technology working hand in glove to go out into the world driven by a desire to make money, a desire to spread your way of thinking, which you presume is best, then yes, the late 19th century to the 20th century was a period of where the world was incredibly vulnerable. All these Tahitian islands, all of the Amazon. I mean, we see it now. The uncontacted people that remain are not in jeopardy because evangelists are coming to change their religion. They're just in jeopardy because people are chopping down their trees. The lumberjacks
and giving them Netflix.
Yeah, the lumberjacks in the Amazon don't care about the uncontacted people's culture. They're not against it or for it. They're just coming. They're coming for the material wealth, and that was also true in the 20th century. And this desire to be culturally anthropological was a desire to preserve, or at least understand things in their own context before they were, in some ways, maybe inevitably destroyed or preserved in a glass box. One of these people, one of these sort of, you can only describe them as a generation of characters, really.
Are they all eccentrics?
And I'm not sure whether it's the eccentricity that drives the science or the science that drives the eccentricity. But if you think about Darwin, Darwin put himself on a boat where he was, you know, a naturalist, like not really not as important as a barrel maker, right? Yeah. I mean,
he's below cabin boy.
Yeah, there are people that matter, and then there are people that are there because they represent a kind of aristocratic interest in the natural world from the standpoint of a scientist rather than just a, like, are these birds good to eat? Can we chop down these trees and sell them on the market? In the 20th century, and I'm talking about during the period right around the Second World War, a Norwegian by the name of Thor Heyerdahl was kind of trying to make a name for himself as a young man as a cultural anthropologist, or as just an anthropologist primarily, putting himself, he and his wife at a very young age, part of their honeymoon actually, headed out into the South Pacific. They went under the pretext of an academic mission to...
That's not a very fun honeymoon.
Well, it is if you're like 22 and 20 and you're both super hot Norwegian science people. They seem to really be into science and into doing science together. And they were going down to the South Pacific to research migration, but animal migration between those islands as part of just the general interest in in Polynesia that was happening at the time. They went to the island of Fatu Hiva, which was, you know, part of the kind of Tahitian, French Polynesian universe. And they got there and decided they were kind of into the wilding a little bit. They were going to go down there.
I'm looking at pictures of the young Heyerdahls, and they are indeed very attractive.
They're super foxy.
I mean, they're Scandinavian, of course they are.
And super into each other. And they went to Fatuhiva, you know, with a with an academic mandate of a kind, a young people that could afford to go do this.
The edge of Google means at any historical topic, and we do this anonymous all the time, you can really judge how attractive the participants are at a moment's notice, which was not always true in class.
Like as soon as we're researching somebody, you and I both have that 1 to 10 scale. Like, is this person foxy? Yeah.
Like in ninth grade when they talked about the Huguenots, you know, nobody was ever like, I wonder what Catherine de Medici
was. She pretty hot? I mean, we made Joan of Arc, I think, in our imaginations a lot hotter than she might have actually been in real life. Did she really look like one of the Go-Go's? I mean, I don't know.
Probably. I mean, in Bill and Ted, she does, so.
But they decided they were going to actually kind of, as we problematically say, go native and actually survived kind of living off the land on Fatuhiva.
We should talk about the Norwegian context of exploration at the time. They came from a culture that was one of the last outposts of explorer-friendly life.
And in a way, one of the first outposts of European explorer-friendly life. If you believe that the first people to arrive—
Vikings.
In the Americas were— the first Europeans to arrive in the Americas were Scandahoovians.
But headlines in the, you know, as late as the 30s were still being made by people like Nansen and Amundsen, who's been on the omnibus before.
Right.
At a time when the rest of the world, it wasn't really top of mind. You know, your heroes in America or China or France were not hardy outdoorsmen looking for the next place the way Norwegian culture seemed to prize, just because of their proximity, I guess, to unexplored polar regions.
Yeah, that's the thing. At the time, the only unexplored regions left were polar ones. And so the Norwegians kind of had they presumed that they had the experience with that kind of environment.
That must mean something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Belgians are only a few hours further from the pole, but they weren't like, you know what? We got this. We got a chance at this.
Here we go. Just pack up the chocolate and coffee and we're on.
Even the Swedes, like, well, we'd have to cross Norway to get there. So what's the
point? All the way up there. But yeah, I think that probably has a lot to do with it. And those Norwegians influenced subsequent Norwegians, but also that mentality kind of then went back to Europe and the Americas. And we saw all of the Lindberghs and the Amelia Earharts.
Yeah, aviation and then space gave exploration two big boosts, technology boosts that maybe we will not see again.
But for a while there, between the Portuguese and aviation and space, there was this generation of Norwegians.
All you had was flinty, leather-faced Norwegian men.
And I mean, in a way, they are the least suited to explore Polynesia.
Yeah. What's Heyerdahl doing? I mean, I get the impulse. Like, if I could choose either to go to Novaya Zemlya or Tahiti, I would also pick Tahiti.
But while he was there and studying the flora and fauna, he also got into the ethnography and tried to understand the local culture and religion. And he learned some of the language, and in the process started to develop a theory. And the conventional wisdom was that Polynesia was settled by migrant explorer peoples from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Polynesian people and they seem like a subgroup of the indigenous populations of Asian archipelagos.
Yeah, island hopping from India and China down to
Indonesia,
Southeast Asia, Indonesia. Yeah.
And if you think about Southeast Asia as being an area that was conquered by the Chinese, mm-hmm. who were a kind of northern people that moved south, what we think of now as the sort of Asian population of that area, they were actually pushing out indigenous populations that were much more akin to Polynesians. This was the theory, but this was the generally accepted theory, but Thor Heyerdahl started to develop an alternate theory, which was that because of the currents of the South Pacific and because of things that he identified in Polynesian myth and lore and origin stories, connections to the cultures of South America, specifically Peru, he started to develop a theory in his head that the original Polynesians actually came from the East, from South America.
All the way across the Pacific.
Rather than island hopping from
the West. Because most of the Polynesian islands he's studying are a good deal closer to the Asian side of the Pacific Rim than the South American side.
They are, but they're way out there. And once those Southern Pacific...
It's a bit of a mystery how those islands even got settled, because the navigational feats required to get there, you know, would have daunted any European in the age of sail.
Right.
Much less people on rafts.
Pretty incredible. And when you think about it, once you understand the southern currents, the way the ocean is, you know, the ocean works as a giant gyre in different hemispheres, it's kind of even more incredible, because a lot of time coming from Asia, you would be sailing against what was the current.
Hmm.
So he developed this theory that you could put a raft in Peru and
just follow the prevailing tides and winds.
Sail to Tahiti with very little technology, with no, in a way, with no rudder. That a big enough raft with enough provisions and a settling population.
What's the distance like? And there's not a lot of islands in the way. I mean, once you pass the Galapagos,
the distance is about 6 or 7,000 kilometers
from Callao, Peru to, let's say, Papeete, Tahiti. Yeah, almost 5,000 miles by the most direct route.
Right, 5,000 miles, about 7,000 kilometers.
Yikes!
But if you know, with the current working as it does, Tor estimated that that an unpowered raft with a rudimentary sail could actually make the journey in about 3 months. 97 days, he said, was the fastest that you could make that journey, and that seemed very doable and also very plausible. Plausible in the the same way that that you see palm trees appear on distant islands because the coconut just floated there. Birds alighted upon a log. And
but you do have to posit an ancient Incan person, not Inc and person, but
right,
an ancient Peruvian. I mean, Heyerdahl knew those islands were out there. This person has to just have 3 months of provisions and just head out.
Or they are fishermen.
They get lost.
And they get lost. They get blown out to sea. They're able to survive.
Imagine
from the
finding
ocean.
Tahiti accidentally.
I know. After 3 months of like, I'm still alive. I'm eating flying fish. And wait a minute. Like, whoa, hello. The problem is that, you know, in order to have a sustainable population, you'd need to have more than just a boat of a couple of lost fishermen, right? You eventually need to have
a mermaid,
and there is some suggestion, and we'll get to that in a minute, that what you have is Peruvians washing up on the shore and finding people who have migrated from the Asian side. It's I think in human history you have to go pretty far back into the mists of time to actually arrive somewhere where there's nobody.
That's why the genomic record is so incomplete, because it's so likely to be a melange of different complicated migrations meeting up and then splitting.
Yeah, I mean, you show up somewhere and there's already a Robinson Crusoe there.
I thought you were going to say there's a Red Robin there.
There's a Red Robin there, and they're serving big hot fudge sundaes that aren't as good as they used to be, weirdly. So it's not until after the war that Tor has advanced his theory to the point he's written his thesis. He's tried to get it published. No one wants anything to do with it because it flies in the face of not just conventional wisdom but kind of logic.
And he is just a bit of a dabbler.
He's not he's young still, and so not really a fully fledged member of the National Geographic Society. And in fact, they reject his proposal. And he decides, or they reject his thesis, and he decides that the way to prove it, the way to get the attention, is to actually build a Stone Age raft using the material available to someone in Peru. You know, to a pre-contact Peru, no steel, nothing but what would really be stone tools, and to put himself in the water. Tor cannot swim, and he has no history of. I mean, he's the one Norwegian that has never been on a boat.
Well, I guess that would be a great test of it then. If even this guy can do it,
this ding dong,
then think what an experienced South American fisherman could do.
So he goes around, he tries to get support for this idea.
This is a very post-war idea, by the way, that you should, that you can sell your idea with smart marketing.
Right.
It's hard to imagine another time where an explorer would have been like, I know, nobody's reading my paper. I'm going to
prove it.
I'm going to duplicate it with newsreels.
And there was a super consciousness of publicity in Tor and his eventual crew that kind of in their own retelling of the story, you know, of course they mask it with a lot of humility.
It can't get in the way of science, right? When you've got a myth to promote.
Right, when it seems like a publicity stunt. But it is part of that era of lay explorer who... you know, there was a lot of conventional wisdom that was dispelled by experimentation.
Right.
And a lot of those huffy longbeards at the Royal Geographical Society found out that, oh, it turns out that some young upstart actually ended up being able to demonstrate their revolutionary theory.
Their monocle splashes into their soup.
So Tor recruits a crew, and maybe just by coincidence, they're all Norwegians.
Oh, I was about to say, is it a ragtag crew? Exactly. A motley crew? It is not.
It's a ragtag motley crew if you're drawing only from Norway and Sweden. There was one Swede.
It's like the World War II movie, except every soldier is like Christiansen, right. Torvaldsen, Henriksen. The diversity hires one Swede.
Was one Swedish guy. But there were a couple of, World War II. I mean, this is the era immediately after World War II where the world must feel very different. I mean, this area was part of, it was very in contention during the war.
But probably easy to find people with South Pacific naval experience. Is that who he got?
It is not. No, he got, there is one person on the ship. His name was Erik Hesselberg. He was an actual...
He'd been on a boat. But it was a ferry to Estonia.
He could use a sextant. He was a sailor. Understood, you know, the basics of navigation.
Is it cheating to use a sextant? Was he trying to only duplicate navigational stuff that might have been available to a... How long ago are we talking here? When does he think this migration happened? BC or AD?
Oh, no. He's thinking that the migration happened in 1200, okay. 1100. Pre-contact, but...
But not long.
But not that long. I mean, an era where the archaeological record is pretty clear that the Aztec world and the Incan world were, they had large cities.
They could navigate by the stars.
Yeah, they were certainly, you know, maybe pre-modern, but industrialized or urban. But in a boat with no rudder.
Why doesn't it have a rudder?
Well, I mean, it has
Does he think the Incas didn't have a rudder?
It has a rudimentary rudder and a kind of like rudimentary sail, but it's not that they weren't able to adjust their path, really. They couldn't fight the current.
You can't steer that much.
No.
You're kind of at the mercy of the Pacific.
And in fact, it was something that they were always mindful of. If one of them fell off, they couldn't really turn the boat around.
Oh.
There were instances where they needed, you know, during storms or whatever, they needed to tie themselves to their boat because the alternative if one of them was swept off, you know, they would just sit and watch them bob into the distance.
Much is made of this, by the way, at the Kon-Tiki Museum in Oslo.
Oh, have you been to the Kon-Tiki Museum?
A couple years
ago. Oh, no kidding. Why am I doing this show? You should be doing this show.
I don't actually remember much of the. It's next to the much better Fram Museum, which is built around the a Norwegian polar exploration ship, and it's all about Arctic exploration.
Oh,
and that's kind of the flashy museum out there. And across the street is the little Kon-Tiki Museum, which I think Heyerdahl might have funded himself, because as you mentioned, he is a bit of a self-promoter and a marketing-minded explorer.
Actually, it was the Kon-Tiki Museum was the brainchild of one of the men on his crew, but it wasn't Tor.
Oh, interesting.
It was, you know, these guys all went on to other exploits.
It has a bit of a family foundation feel, and it's all built around. They still have the original Kon-Tiki raft, and at first you're like, oh, it's kind of big, and then you realize, well, it's not really big to be on there with 12 guys for however long it was, a matter of months, right?
Right.
They show the documentary. I remember because Tor Heyerdahl. I don't believe the director wins the Oscar, but his movie about the expedition won a Best Documentary Oscar.
In fact, Tor Heyerdahl was the director of the documentary.
But the producer wins the Oscar is what I'm saying.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Best Documentary.
So he is not theoretically. I think the Oscar might be on display there, but it's not inscribed to him. It's inscribed to whoever produced it. So you watch a great first-person movie about their adventures, which makes much of the lashing yourself to the sail when the seas are stormy.
Right.
There's kind of a kids version of the story that follows parallel to the exhibit. So, you know, at a lower level of the wall, a child can follow, and it's all narrated by a happy crab who's like, let me tell you about my friend Tor. And when you get to the end of that, my kids were kind of half enjoying, they were a little too old for the happy crab, but they were enjoying. And when you get to the end, the crab reveals the secret, which is that he's real. Like, there actually was a mascot crab aboard the Kon-Tiki. I don't remember the name. But this cartoon character who's been narrating the Kon-Tiki adventure for kids actually is based on a real crab. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
There was a crab, and they actually had a parrot, a pet parrot by the name of Larita. And the parrot was a fun friend who joined them until halfway across the ocean.
These guys are like Disney princesses.
They are.
They've got a crab and a parrot.
Except the parrot, like, at one point flew off from the raft and landed in the sea, which is not a parrot's normal environment. And
it's a sea parrot.
And they just kept sailing on and lost the parrot.
Oh, the parrot's a casualty.
Yeah, but the crab remained, I think, all the way across.
I'm surprised the parrot didn't eat the crab.
Well, or the crab eat the parrot in the end.
Yeah, the crabs ate the parrot. I thought it was going to be a nice thing, like Noah's Ark, where the parrot flies away and that's how you know there's dry land.
Or that's how you know that there are now parrots in French Polynesia.
So were there other casualties?
No. So Eric Hasselberg was the navigator. They had two radio operators, and this is another...
Well, come on.
I know. And both of them had worked in the Norwegian resistance during the war, and it gives you a sense of, I mean, I don't think that Tor had any intention of being rescued. They were way too far away to be rescued, even if they had been able to call for help. So, and this was, as your dad can attest, the era of shortwave radio, the kind of early peak of international shortwave nerds.
Well, they could have reached somebody.
And they did. And they were in semi-constant contact with the Norwegian embassy, which I think was...
That's not who I'd call first.
Well, what they had to do was call these guys in Los Angeles, call shortwave operators around the world. We need you to send this message to the Norwegian embassy. We're doing great, and here are our coordinates.
The Norwegian embassy to whom? Is this in Peru, or?
I guess the Norwegian...
Just the Norwegian State Department.
Ultimately, send it back to Norway was the message.
I see. Whoever the nearest embassy is.
But what they really meant was send this to the New York Times, because it became gradually a real news event. Like, these guys are out there. It was a news event. Tor was smart enough to make it a news event that he was attempting this, and he actually got the Peruvian government to aid the preparation because he made the case to them, hey, we're trying to prove that French Polynesia, you know, that all of Polynesia was settled by Peruvians.
Oh.
And the Peruvian government was like, this will...
Si, senor.
Yes, this will help us some way.
And it's funny to think that Thor is doing this on the basis just of some very vaguely sketched ideas that the sun creation myth that he heard from a Polynesian guy is similar to some Incan book he read.
Yeah, and he named the boat Contiki after an Incan god, or the Inca creator god, Viracocha, who's also known as Contiki. But, you know, like the iconography of Viracocha doesn't not resemble the kind of tiki gods of Polynesia that sort of immediately after this became a global decorating icon.
I mean, our tiki bar American culture comes from
World War II.
Yeah, it's a Maori word for an actual, you know, the actual tiki carvings. So if his Viracocha etymology is legit, I guess it's just a coincidence then.
Well, that's the thing.
That
there's a lot of Thor Heyerdahl's ethnography that, because subsequent to Contiki, he went on in his life to other adventures, all trying to prove his sort of various migration theories. One of which was that Norway, in fact, was settled by
Peruvians.
No, by people from Azerbaijan. And a lot of that was...
Wait, Azerbaijan? Isn't that landlocked?
Well, that's right. But they would have traveled up to rivers and then, you know, rivers that were headed to the North Sea. And a lot of that was based on just the fact that in Azerbaijani, the name of their capital city their capital city was Azir.
It's the kind of thing where a single coincidence lets him think he's onto something.
The mythology of Sweden says that the gods came from Azir, and that is phonetically close enough to Azerbaijan that, I mean, he had a lot of these theories. And one of the problematic aspects of Thor's theories is that his ancient Peruvians were tall and blonde.
Wait, what?
That.
What does he think happened to these mysterious blonde Peruvians?
Well, so he had a lot of theories about Easter Island and the culture of Easter Island, which, according to Thor, when Europeans first contacted Easter Island, there was a kind of vibrant culture there that was multiracial. There were tall white people on Easter Island. There were short brown people on Easter Island.
And then the big people with the big heads.
Well, there were the groups of people on Easter Island in its initial contact when Admiral Roggeveen discovered the island in 1722. There were Native Americans, people that were kind of identified as people from the Northwest Coast.
It's a real melting pot, the Easter Island.
There were Polynesians, and there were Anglo-appearing people. That was in 1722. By the time James Cook got there in 1774, 50 years later, the people of Easter Island were entirely Polynesian. There had obviously been a period of great deprivation, and Easter Island was poor, and the people were starving.
But somehow a really diverse group of ocean-going peoples had kind of converged on it.
Which, according to the oral tradition of Easter Island, there were the ruling class of Easter Island in the pre-contact years were known as the Long Ears, and the sort of working class of Easter Island were the Short Ears. And somewhere between these
this
two...
This is a Star Trek episode.
I know.
Don't you see? His ears are long.
The Short Ears, the Star-Bellied Sneetches. And so in this 50-year period post-contact, the short ears rebelled against the long ears and killed them all. But so Tor believed that there had these sort of prehistory Viking explorations of the New World had produced perhaps a race of Americans who were Vikings or Viking descendant, who then were
Scandinavian descent through the Americas
and then and exploring the other side to Polynesia. But also that the Northwest Coast Indians were also exploring the South Atlantic, or I'm sorry, the South Pacific.
That seems less impossible.
Less impossible, right? You get it. You've already got your ocean going.
They've got canoes.
But that they were all sort of, you know, out there living together in a multicultural, a real
Mos Eisley vibe.
Right. Tor also had other theories. He later on in life sailed from Africa to the Bahamas on a raft made in the Egyptian style out of reeds.
Oh.
To prove that that South America could also have been settled by Mesopotamians.
I guess none of this actually settles the fact of whether it did happen, but the fact that he proved that it could happen is interesting enough.
It's interesting, and
it's a possibility that scientists can't reject out of hand now. Well, that's thousands of miles. Of course, that didn't happen.
They can't reject it out of hand until you start to be able to read the DNA.
Right.
And it's sort of...
It hasn't held up?
It's revealed that Polynesians have mostly DNA that can be traced to Asia.
Oh, John.
But...
You're telling me that parrot died for nothing?
But the crab lived. But there is South American indigenous DNA in small quantities that has been demonstrated to be prehistoric. So not contaminated by post age of exploration contact, but DNA that predates that contact.
So there could have been migration in that direction. It just wasn't
the primary flow. Right. Yeah. And it does seem possible. And in a way, I think what Kon-Tiki proved was that there was a global connectedness that our kind of mythology around the age of exploration, that, you know, that prehistoric peoples walked across a land bridge and settled the Americas, but that they had
everything was in a steady state for thousands of years until white people got sails.
And then white people got sails, and all of a sudden the world became imbalanced. Yeah. But the idea that people were traveling from Africa to South America, from South America to Polynesia, back and forth across the Atlantic and the Pacific on, I guess, primitive boats. But when you think about the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria,
they're pretty small, primitive boats too.
Those boats were the size of a large Winnebago, and a lot. You know, there were an awful lot of those boats that didn't make it.
The Nina Bago, the Pinta Bago, all this stuff must have really spoken to like a 40s and 50s era audience that really loved this idea of this kind of less threatening idea of diversity. You know, kind of the Disney "It's a Small World" idea that. That, you know, we really were all one people, and maybe the Africans knew the Caribbeans, and the Egyptians knew the, and the Incans knew the Polynesians. You know, that's a kind of a sunny, optimistic mid-century children's song version of multiculturalism that people were kind of into.
It was very popular at the time. His book was a bestseller. So in the end, they made it across in 100 days.
Wow.
And it's amazing.
That's a long time to have a dozen guys on that raft.
It is. I'm sure they hated each other's guts, you know, and they brought water and food.
We learned from the Amundsen's airship entry that at least they didn't bring Italians.
There were no Italians. It was all Scandahoovians. So when they were mad at each other, I'm sure they were just quiet.
They bottled it up. They wrote six-volume memoirs about their feelings.
They did. They did. Six-volume memoirs where they never really quite talked about their feelings. They talked about their feelings the whole time, but never quite. And in proving this was possible, they became international celebrities. They were, as you say, the documentary about it won the Academy Award. You know, it made his career. It did not, in the end, Thor Heyerdahl's theories were not accepted by academia. He did not go on to become the great scientist he hoped to be.
So still more of a celebrity and a popular figure.
And I think a very popular figure in Norway, you know, one of their kind of legendary explorers.
Maybe the last, huh?
But, you know, but a stunt explorer. Weirdly,
Evel Knievel.
An Evel Knievel. Weirdly, not the last, because once this had been done...
People wanted to do it blindfolded.
People wanted to do it over and over. And in the time from the early 50s, to as recently as November 2015, when the Kon-Tiki 2 launched from Peru.
The imaginatively named Kon-Tiki 2.
Headed to Easter Island. There have been, not innumerable, because you can enumerate them, but numerous attempts to raft across all the oceans to prove all manner of connection between places. Put your raft in, put 5 or 10 of your closest friends, and set off to follow the current.
Are you going to try it? I know you like to be on the edge of things.
You know, I'm kind of I'm more of the beachcomber model. I like to pick up the foot-filled tennis shoes that come through these ocean gyres.
you like the wreckage of the rafts to wash up. That makes you feel like you've made the right choice. And that concludes Kon-Tiki. Entry 692.MT1424, certificate number 18688 in the omnibus. Futurelings, you may be living in a one continent Pangea world where there is no need for ocean migration. Or you could all be ocean dwellers where your big migrations are across land. Can you imagine our cephalopod listeners wondering if they can walk across Mexico to get to the Caribbean?
They climb up and go over a mountain, and they get to the top of the mountain, which is 2,500 feet.
It's like a Kon-Tiki size thing, but it actually is a Winnebago. Like it's made of, like they've tried to make shell wheels out of seashells. They're rolling laboriously across the desert. We would love to hear about your inverse Kon-Tiki wanderings from your era. You can send those to us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can find us, you can share them with your fellow omnibus aficionados at the Futurelings Facebook site or subreddit or Discord. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, etc., at Omnibus Project or at John Roderick. I added an extra syllable. John Roderick.
John Roderick.
It's a John Roderick. Get out of my Zeppelin.
Giovanni Rodrigo.
And at Ken Jennings. You can send us physical items if you have access to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155.
What do you got there? You got some mail, didn't you? Opening the mail.
David Sheehy has sent you this.
What is it? Whoop.
Not us, to you.
Oh, it's some weird Adidas performance underwear.
Now, tell me what performance underwear is. What exactly, what feats are you performing with the underwear clad part of your body?
I have no idea. It's also size XXL.
Yeah, the note says extra XX large, performant nubile. Thanks, David.
I don't know. And it kind of, did you half open it, or was it already half open?
Oh, no, I do not open your underwear.
Oh, I see.
At least not on the air.
Well, you can open it even, it's not like
it's like a Ziploc bag. Well, I guess underwear doesn't go bad like fruit roll-ups.
I'm afraid that XXL may be just too big for me. Look at these big old underwears. I'm not sure I can wear these. These would be very blousy on me.
I don't know if it's blousy if it's the below the blouse part of
your
body.
Look at them. I could pull them all the way up above my navel.
If that's what you want, I guess.
Well, you're the one that has to look at it. What do you think?
It's looking good.
Does that make you feel like doing a podcast? Hello.
You're going to have to take off everything else first. I can't tell. Oh. We also got a copy of Stubby the War Dog.
Sure.
About a World War II hero.
That seems like a back way to get us to do an episode on Stubby.
Well, it's not even a back way. I wish I had the name here. But it did not appear to come from the seller. But this is somebody who has been requesting Stubby the War Dog
multiple times
in the past, and I think maybe he thinks sending us a children's book about Stubby will seal the deal.
You know, if you subscribe to our Patreon, you can insist that we do your weird Stubby the War Dog.
You know, we're always happy to take suggestions.
Yes, that's true too.
But if you support Omnibus at the Washing Bear level,
mm-hmm.
in addition to all the other
Trash Panda
perks, the bonus episode, the images from the online feed, the autographed show notes personally mailed to you, you can actually request an entry of your choice that shoots to the top of our list.
Washing Bear.
Here it is. Frank Caruzzi, I think, who is recently eligible. So Stubby the War Dog may be joining the Omnibus sooner than we think.
So which one of us does Stubby the War Dog? I like war dogs. You like stubs.
You like war, and I like dogs.
That's true.
You're a cat person. So.
You have two dogs. I have zero dogs. Maybe you're the one.
I have zero war podcasts, and you have one war podcast.
Yeah, that's right. One award-winning war podcast.
Thank you for the book, Frank. We will. John and I will check it out and fight over the rights to Stubby's life story.
It's interesting. Washing bears that send episodes to us very seldom tag them to one or the other of us. They seem to think that we're indistinguishable from one another.
And you and I can usually tell. Like if somebody sends us three things,
and one of them is trains that are used
to carry nuclear weapons,
right? It seems like one of us is going to gravitate to it.
It will cry out.
If one of us is a mathematician that also was a transmogrified super mathematician.
And we want to keep the Omnibus aesthetic intact, but we don't. Right. Generally, the suggestions we get are right down the plate for things that would make great shows anyway.
Yeah.
So we have enjoyed having the input. It hasn't changed this so fundamentally, except for the financial viability of the show. Omnibus is now on very stable ground thanks to our Patreon supporters. We thank you. We appreciate it. For those of you who have considered supporting the show in the past, you might want to try it out and just see how amazing the benefits of membership are. Let's see. I did the post office box. I covered it.
Yeah.
What a great job I did.
You did. You're amazing, Ken.
It's not exactly going across the South Pacific with 12 buddies, but
people don't give you enough credit for being America's smartest boy.
For being able to remember three or four things.
Yes, they do.
it's literally the only thing I hear.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, but we hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.